everyone. It's a great pleasure to be with you here today at APHA. Unlike my colleagues, this is my first APHA meeting, so it's really exciting to be here and get to know a lot of folks and see a lot of folks I've been working with over the last several years. I'm not new to public health, but definitely new to the APHA meeting. And want to say at the outset, I was so impressed with the number of hands that went up. Many of you are working with your policymakers at the local and perhaps state level. It's hard work, as you all know, because you're doing it. And I can say, whether it was at the American Heart Association or AARP or now at the Trust for America's Health, the work that we do to engage those lawmakers is not easy. It's tough, and you know, you just stay at it. And my colleague Sana Chahimi is here from the Prevention Institute, and we've been really working together, I think, over the last several years now to figure out how do we get the public health community more mobilized to do the kind of work that you're doing in this room to engage your policymakers. So I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with the Trust for America's Health, but we are an organization based in Washington, D.C. We're pretty small, but folks outside the Beltway generally know us for the reports that we produce on a variety of topics. We do three annual reports, one on obesity, one on funding for public health at the state level, and then another on infectious disease and disaster preparedness. So we try to cover the gamut, so to speak, of chronic disease and infectious disease. We call it internally the things that kill you quickly and the things that kill you slowly is how we sort of balance our portfolio. But we try to raise awareness through these reports. And inside the Beltway, we spend a lot of our time and efforts developing policy. So I'm not sure how many folks in the room are familiar with the Prevention and Public Health Fund or the National Prevention Strategy. Can I get a show of hands on the Prevention Fund? Wonderful. And the National Prevention Strategy? Wonderful. Okay. So we've been sort of working to coalesce partners to continue to build a wide range of support for both of those efforts. So the trust, as you may know, we don't have a membership. So we do our work through the generous support of folks like the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the California Endowment, W.K. Kellogg Foundation, which is wonderful, but no membership. We do not take federal dollars, and we do not take corporate dollars. So we are very reliant on partners to do our work. So about 3.5 years ago, I joined the trust to really dig deep and figure out how we could build our work in relationships with non-traditional partners, so the faith-based community, certainly educational organizations, the business community, hospitals, providers, health plans, you know, the gamut. So today, on the Prevention and Public Health Fund supporters list, this has been a list we've been building for several years since it passed as part of the Affordable Care Act, we have over 800 national and state organizations representing a variety of these sectors. And that's been very intentional on our part. However, we're following your lead out in communities. The community transformation grants, which were supported by the Prevention and Public Health Fund, although sunsetted, are now, the Prevention Fund's now supporting things like the CDC grants like 1305, 1422. They're really called state public health actions to improve heart disease, diabetes, school health, and so forth. But those are programs that without the Prevention Fund would be tough to preserve. And so we're following your lead and the partnerships you're creating with these different sectors at the community level and trying to harness it on the national level. So I don't have time to go deep into all those sectors in terms of what we're doing, but I wanted to pull out one in particular on the business community. This has been a couple years in the making, but we've tried to really reach out to the gamut of the business community, so the small business majority on the progressive end, to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and their foundation on the more conservative end, and then folks in the middle, like the National Business Coalition on Health. And last year, we were very lucky with the support of the National Business Coalition on Health and their affiliate, the Mid-Atlantic Business Group on Health, to work with them in partnership to visit the entire Maryland delegation. So they're two senators and their elected representatives. And we made this happen because The Mid-Atlantic Business Group on Health was already engaged in community transformation grant efforts. Maryland Department of Public Health and Mental Hygiene had engaged them as part of their workplace wellness efforts. But what the Mid-Atlantic Business Group didn't know was the whole scope of the work being done in the community transformation grants. And when they understood that it was everything from multi-unit smoke-free housing to obesity prevention and working deeply in communities, they said, hey, we're investing in workplace wellness, but then we're sending folks home to communities, so this is so relevant and to what we do. And they said, we want to join you. So they recruited five of their employer organizations to go with us on the Hill and spent the whole day there sort of talking about why business likes this stuff, why they think it's important, why tobacco cessation and obesity prevention is good. So that was step one, but we know we need to keep building that drumbeat. And so with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation, they have a health and wellness group that meets pretty regularly with leadership from a lot of employers. And they said, you know, we've been doing workplace wellness, but we're not moving the needle. What else can we do? And we said, well, community prevention. When you send folks home, you know, let's keep them healthy at home, too, right? So they really got that. So we just did a site visit with the Chamber Foundation. We had about 20 employers and folks from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and from the Let's Move office all go to Philly to look at what they're doing with their employers in Philadelphia. And so, you know, we didn't know this at the time. GlaxoSmithKline made a $5 million pledge to get Healthy Philly to further spur those efforts as part of our site visit, which was really exciting. So when you take the community's putting prevention to work efforts that led to the community transformation grant efforts that have now led to Mayor Nutter in Philadelphia providing $2 million to spur further Get Healthy Philly efforts, now to the private investment from GlaxoSmithKline, you start to see that sustainability at work. And so that idea of these private-public partnerships, no one can do it alone, is something that we're really trying to seed on the Hill, particularly in light of the outcome of the elections and knowing it is not going to get easier in the next couple of years to make these investments sustainable. And another effort, you know, again, with the leadership of folks in the field like yourselves with the community transformation grants, we thought, you know other agencies are making investments in community prevention. We know there's synergy, like the National Prevention Strategy, that's 20 federal agencies coming together to look at health in all policies. We know there's synergy here, but where is it? So we built something quite recently over the last year. It's called the Community Prevention Grants Dashboard. And believe it or not, in the year that we've been looking at this, there's over 42 and more to come. Now we're digging deep on the private side. Agencies investing in community prevention. So everybody from the Administration on Aging, their chronic disease self-management program work that was part of the CTG out in California, to the Department of Education and their Promised Neighborhoods effort, to U.S. Department of Transportation, the Ag Department, all of these folks are supporting community prevention. So we thought, well, this is interesting. We have it sort of broken down by the state and the county level, and we thought, what does this mean? You know, really, when you look at this spreadsheet and you look across, what is this story it's really telling? So we did analysis, and we talked to folks like you, got on the phone and said, help us understand. Are you aware of these grants? And largely across the board, what we found from these conversations was, you know, our colleagues in public health knew about other efforts within the public health department, but not so much about things outside the public health department. So it created, in our conversation, sort of an opening for them to say, huh, I know that person over at HUD. I just haven't talked to them about this. Or, you know, like Dr. Maya in Philadelphia, who's been a very patient man with us as we try to figure out the Philly site visit, said, well, I didn't know Robert Wood Johnson had a Roadmaps to Health grant right here in my backyard. So what we're trying to do is create openness and then also share this with the federal agencies to help try to build these bridges together as part of this effort. So the analysis in the 10 states, what we decided to do was build on the themes that we found in the conversations and look for trends. So what were we hearing from these communities sort of across the board, and were there themes? And sure enough, these were the four sort of overall categories. I don't have time to go into them all today, but I wanted to spend a little bit of time on leadership and political will. You may recognize some of these folks. Senator Harkin is the reason we have the Prevention and Public Health Fund. He's about to retire at the end of the year. So you could say we're sort of sweating bullets in Washington, trying to figure out how the gauntlet will be passed to the next generations of leaders for public health. That's still a big unknown. Mayor Nutter, who's been providing leadership in Philadelphia, and then this is Mayor Pickering from Hernando, Mississippi, who spurred a whole effort in his community to reverse the obesity trend. And with that, I want to kind of talk a minute about Mayor Nutter, because what he did, I think even before the National Prevention Strategy, was get all the folks that report to him, all the agency heads around the table, and said, here are my priorities. How are we all going to work to reduce obesity in the city? And so that really started with CPPW funding, of course, and then community transformation grant funding. But he's been able to sort of be that visible presence that keeps everybody accountable. And so what we learned on our site visit that we didn't know before we went was that Department of Transportation has been at the table in these conversations. And so for the first time, at their own sort of impetus, they said, what can we do? So red light camera dollars, when you go through a red light, you get a ticket in the mail. Part of those funds now are going to public health messaging and an awareness campaign, a media campaign, to help promote better safety, public safety, both for pedestrians and bicyclists and so forth. So that's an example of how that leadership can permeate these different agencies. And I'm sure there's many examples here in the room. But this concept of leadership and political will, the strength of political will, in talking to the communities that we've been working with, these key themes sort of emerged that I want to quickly share with you if I can find them. Importance of leadership. So we know where strong leadership exists. That's definitely a key to success. Whether it was Denver, Philly, Chicago, San Diego, Akron, Omaha, Rochester, that was the theme amongst all of these folks. And even where they had that sort of leadership, like in Akron, it can all go away very quickly, as we all know. They had been working with the Akron Accountable Care Community, with the hospitals, with the health plans, had this wonderful shared savings model that we've written up at TIFA and have looked to as a model. And the hospital leadership changed. And now things look very different in Akron in terms of the Accountable Care Community. So we brought Janine in. We just did a conference recently with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. We said, Janine, share your lessons learned. And we want to put Janine on the roadshow now because she did this amazing work with all her partners. And we want folks to sort of benefit from what's happened in Akron. But the infrastructure, the partnerships are still there. It's just kind of trying to rebuild now. A little bit with some of the leadership changes. So, you know, can you anticipate those changes? Can you plan a little bit when you know where your support's not the strongest? Can you work with your partners to figure out how to strengthen that? Where is support the strongest? How can those folks with that leadership be influential to bring other people along? Certainly strength of political will. Can you ensure incoming policymakers? We just had elections, as we all know. We have folks coming in. How do we get this on their radar in a positive way and bring our partners to bear, like perhaps some of the sectors and partners that you have who have a little more flexibility perhaps to talk to their policymakers? Can we give them the information to help go promote the work that's happening? And then engagement of elected officials, certainly. We know we have a continuing challenge, even in Philadelphia, where they've done all this great work, have all these great results. They brought down childhood obesity rates, smoking rates. Even with Mayor Nutter and his ability to affect and talk with their Pennsylvania, their delegation, there's still that disconnect. And the disconnect is people need to hear from folks in the communities about the importance of these investments. And, you know, when we interview policymakers on the Hill to say what motivates you, what drives you, we hear this over and over again. It's the folks in the grassroots that take the time to come talk to me that carry the most weight with me. How is this benefiting my constituents? And if they don't hear from the constituents, they're not going to be there because they don't see people's faces that this work is there to improve. And I want to, this is my last slide, and I want to just talk for a minute about our wonderful partner in Washington State. This is the work of the Foundation for Healthier Generations. They do a lot of policy work in Washington. And I'm not sure everybody can see this, and I'd be happy to send it to anybody who's interested. But this is their one-pagers. They do them on all their topical issues. And these were built around the community transformation grants and trying to show the impact of the work and educate policymakers about the work. And they made these broadly available, so when their coalition partners were doing visits, everybody was speaking from the same songbook. So if you have these kind of materials, and we know many of you do because you send them to us, make sure you know, that you do share them with us because we do hold these up as examples, but make sure there's a consistent message going to your policymakers. So finally, in summary, Elena was really good, our moderator, about saying, what are your key takeaways? So my key takeaways are, you know, don't be afraid to start the conversation. I know there's a lot of anxiety around engaging federal lawmakers. What do I have to bring to these folks that's going to resonate? But in lieu of them hearing anything, they assume nothing's happening and there's no support for this work. So start the conversation as best you can, and perhaps with the policymakers you're already working with, can they be advocates for the work that you're doing and influence up through their chain of command, so to speak. Ask your partners to take the lead. We never dreamed the Mid-Atlantic Business Group on Health would spend a day with us on the Hill doing this, but we asked them and they said yes. So don't be afraid to ask. Certainly provide the data and resources because public health is so good at that, and your partners can help you translate that. You know, the business community helped us put that data and statistics about the work happening, like in Allegheny County, Maryland, about multi-unit smoke-free housing, into words that were impactful that they thought would resonate with the business community and the folks on the Hill with us that day with policymakers. And certainly, money for public health and things like the new Partnerships to Improve Community Health grants, the state public health actions work, CDC's funding, will not be sustainable. There is still no bipartisan support on the Hill for these programs. They agree we can get bipartisan support all day long on the idea of prevention and the investments businesses make in workplace wellness, but we can't get people to cross the aisle because there's still this political polarization, as you're probably seeing in your states and communities, around the Affordable Care Act. So we have to make this very concrete examples where the sectors that you're working with are engaged and how you're all partnering to make change and why that's so important. So with that, thank you. It was a pleasure being here, and I'm happy to take any questions. Yeah. Elena, I should defer to you.
What I'd love to hear is, I realize that some of you may need to get going to the airport, et cetera, but for those of you who are here and would like to engage a little bit more in terms of what you're doing and tips that you can provide and share with others about approaching legislators about change, one of the things, Sue, as you were going over your takeaways, I kept thinking there isn't something here about language access or affinity or cultural affinity, and that could be relevant to all of you, actually, and that's something that's particularly relevant to the Caucus Collaborative, which I'm a member of, and I would imagine you guys deal with this whole thing of, you know, fastest growing populations, Asian, second to that, Pacific Islanders, Latinos, next type of thing. So as we leave this conference, our big goal here is to build the healthiest nation in one generation, and in one generation, population, we're really going to see some double-digit change. So I would like actually to ask all of you a question on what would you do differently in anticipation of this change of 15, 25 years in terms of building the base of support that you need legislatively to make your issue important, sustainable, and scalable?
So that's an incredibly good question. I wish I thought about that a little more before stepping up here. But I would say, you know, when we think about change, whether it was at AARP or HART, particularly at AARP, when you look at financial insecurity, you know, Social Security is a big issue at AARP and Medicare, and how do you preserve these things? And you look at the numbers of the saving rates in the country, and you go to HART and you look at the stroke belt and so forth. It's all undergirded by the exact same sort of conundrum. It's the same people afflicted by these same things. And so, you know, I've been talking to Sana a lot about this. We've been doing a tremendous amount of outreach and work with the education community. And anytime we've asked for support on the Hill, whether it's a lobby day we're doing, we're getting a lot of support from the education community. And this idea of students coming to the classroom, you know, if they're not, first of all, if they're hungry, they're not gonna give you their attention. But if they're not there, if absenteeism is high in your schools, you know, that's undergirding this whole equation, and you're not going to be able to turn it around. So I would answer that, you know, this partnership, we have a health education collaborative now that we've been working on with our partners from the Healthy School Campaign, and we're trying to drive around metrics. How are we going to know if we're moving the needle on things like school absenteeism? We're finding a lot of states, a lot of communities don't measure this, and so that's one thing that we think could help inform what we're working with, because if the kids aren't in class, how well are they going to do, right? So, and how's that going to change the equation down the road? So we think that's very harnessable, and so we're really excited about that. And the great news there is the business community has been really supportive of some of this, you know, change within the schools. So how can we harness their leadership on this particular issue, like absenteeism and third grade reading level? So we're actually going to do a report early next year. It'll be our first one on early childhood, and we hope that helps set the tone for the partnerships that are needed to change the equation. So that's how I would answer it.
That is a really good question, and I think, again, it goes back to each of us, individuals, every citizen. We've got to really focus on getting and informing people of the importance of voting, getting out midterm, you know, presidential elections, whatever, because, as we've been heard before, the policies and politicians really make a difference, and right now they are polarized. And maybe that's where our country is, but I think as we look down the road, at least as we look for the changes that are going on in the Affordable Care Act and the way businesses operations for HIV/AIDS and services and communities have shifted, that a lot of people, unfortunately, their doors are closing. Community-based organizations don't have the resources. So we're finding that they need to either merge, work closer with health departments, clinics, federal employees, and they need to have their voices heard. And once their voices are heard, then they've got to take action. They've got to continue to be out there saying, look, listen to me, I'm making a difference. Well, showing the data they have to show that, you know, who the population is and how they're making a difference, and then coalescing together. If it's merging, if it's acquisitions, and then once they are a stronger entity, leveraging that information, mobilizing those resources to go to their elected officials, go to their, look at the policies and say, hey, this is not speaking to us, or this is speaking to us, we need to sustain it. So whatever the case may be, people need to take action, and voting through us right now, that's the mechanism that really can get things done on a larger scale. And unfortunately, we're seeing particularly around certain diseases where there's disparities, and particularly in certain communities of color, that's not really happening.
So, Elaine, I'm still thinking about the question, and if I may try and regurgitate the question back to you so I can actually have an appropriate answer. And I think I heard you say that the pendulum, for lack of a better word, is swinging in terms of the changing sort of minority to majority populations? I mean, you talked about cultural changes, and you know, based on that, what would you do in terms of impact or what have you? And I mean, so the issue that I brought forward to you today was the whole concept of environmental justice and environmental justice policies related to moving minorities toward sort of being the more healthier, a healthier nation in one generation, as you say. And I think we need to, as I mentioned when I talked, to think about our metrics and how are we measuring success. And measuring success with where we are today, with the minority populations that we're dealing with. And sort of as we think about that, you know, mimicking or reproducing our successes in some way. So when we see the changes in minorities to majorities taking place, we will have some best practice already out there. And we can scale up that best practice, or we can customize that best practice related to the minority or what have you. So I'm just kind of thinking in that framework, which is the best answer that I have in my mind right now. But really sort of thinking about a way to develop best practices, really measure, have some metrics to say that we're making a difference, and then once we realize that, scale those up and try to make a bigger impact. So that's how I would answer that question.
Address it, you can actually use that as a model.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the area of EJ, it's a question of what's going to happen on the 40th or 50th anniversary.
Right. Exactly.
Do you have a question?
I mentioned some of the hospital outreach we've been doing, and we've been working with this great, wonderful group at HHS. It's the Division of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships, and they've been pulling together hospital leadership to share their lessons learned. And Gary Gunderson, who is in Memphis, did a lot of this type of work, and they've written it up now several times. And my takeaways, this is not his words, but my takeaway, he's now at Wake, and we just had him at this conference we did with the foundation, is creating that peer-to-peer network. And you may already be doing this, but, you know, he's saying what resonates with folks is how they see themselves in the communicator. So is that, you know, whether it's, you know, someone from the community that's dealt with loss or had an impact, you know, trying to put those people in an empowering position to help others. And, you know, so they would do visits to folks from the congregation and the hospital with those folks. And I'm sure you're doing all that too. But the Memphis model is something that's being replicated now around the country, and we look to that as a model. So I just would mention that.
I just want to comment. At the Bronx, we have the
by a father who couldn't stop smoking and lost him at 15. He tried everything. I think now at least with some of the cessation, you know, products are available, it gives me more hope. But nothing's perfect, right? It's a build. We're all evolving.